Hey Property Insiders, I'm Mike Stenhouse, and this is episode 202 of the Inside Property Investing Podcast. Before we get into the show, let's just take a minute to thank the sponsors that make this podcast possible. The UK's top property investors use finance to increase the momentum of their investing. Find out how by speaking to the multi-award-winning broker team at Harvey Bowes. They're more than just mortgage brokers, they're deal creators. Call them on 029-2175-4150 or visit www.harveybowes.com to find out more. Today I'm delighted to be joined by Alice Nock, a mother of two teenage boys who got into property so she could spend more quality time with them and with her husband. She graduated with a degree in law before teaching in primary schools for nearly 10 years, but despite only being a full-time property investor for the last 13 months, that's clearly where her passion now lies, and she's done some amazing deals in that short space of time. Now, Alice, that's obviously just a very high-level overview, though, so help us to get inside your head with a little personal insight into your background and what makes you tick.
Hi, all. So I've obviously been doing property full-time for a very short amount of time. Always wanted to do property since I was very little. Used to go out with mum and dad for the day when I was about 4 or 5 years old, and I always wanted to go and look around the local churches, which is a very odd thing for a four-year-old to do. But I just love the architecture and the buildings, and I've just known that I never wanted to work for someone else forever. I wanted to be able to have the flexibility of working for myself, spending time with my children and my family, having the option to drop everything if I needed to. So moved into property full-time, left my recruitment job that I was doing at the time, which I did for just under 2 years, which was quite a good basis for me because I'd always worked in the public sector. And working in the public sector is very, very different to working for yourself. So as I said, did a couple of years in recruitment, which kind of gave me an insight into businesses, how they work, how they're structured. And then got to the point where I wasn't enjoying my job. I didn't want to get up and go to work in the morning, which, you know, is, well, you know, there's a lot of people out there that do that.
Yeah, it's a very common feeling, isn't it?
Absolutely, and they carry on and they just keep going. And you know, I'm the kind of person that thinks, well, life's too short for that. So I'd arranged to take my husband and the kids as a surprise to Australia for my husband's birthday, for Christmas and New Year, a couple of years ago. And just before we went, I said to my husband, I said, I'm just going to hand my notice in. And he said, but you won't have a job. I said, don't worry, it's fine, I'll make it work. I know, spend the money, I'll do it. And that was a couple of years ago, and so here I am now.
So when you say you've been investing full time for 13 months, had you kind of dabbled with it at all prior to that, or was it? Yeah, okay.
A little bit longer than 13 months. It'll be 2 years in January, so a little over 18 months. So while I was still teaching, as I said, I knew that I wanted to do something with investment. I didn't have a pension, never joined up for the pension scheme. I just didn't think it was worth it. Definitely didn't want to be teaching until I was 68 years old. So I said to my husband, right, we've got a bit of equity in the house. Let's take some of the money out of the house, which my husband, being very risk averse, was a bit like, oh, I'm not sure we should do that. You know, we ought to be paying the mortgage off like you're meant to do. And in the end, I sort of managed to persuade him it was the right thing to do. And we were just about to go on holiday, and we drove past some houses, some fairly new ones. There was about four in a row that were all up for auction. And I said to my husband, I think we should buy one of those. And he said, well, okay, let's do it. Now, I was obviously teaching at the time, and as a teacher, you can't take time off. It doesn't matter what you need time for, you can't take time off. So I couldn't view the property because there was tenants in it. There wasn't a legal pack. I did do a little bit of research beforehand. I went and knocked on a couple of doors of the neighbours just to find out there was a couple that had moved in fairly recently that showed me their searches and things, so that I knew that the area was fairly okay. Sent my dad along to the auction while I was teaching and said, Can I have one of those, please? Any one of them. Don't mind which one. I've got X amount of money to spend. Just get me one of them. Dad did a really good job, got me the one in the best condition for the cheapest price. It already had tenants in. It was only 6 years old, which I thought at the time was great. It was cash flowing immediately, you know, got this investment property and that'll be our pension. And I'd spoken to other people that had got a couple of properties that they were just using as a pension pot. What I didn't realise at the time, because I'd had no formal property training, was that because I bought a house that was only 6 years old, I couldn't add any value to it. And all of my money went into that house and that was it. I couldn't buy another one. So we've just sold that house 5 years on, about 4.5 years on. And even though it didn't cash flow particularly well, it did. It washed its face. We never had any problems from the tenants. We never changed them. They were the same tenants that we bought it with, that left when we sold it. And we made some really good capital appreciation on it in the 4.5 years. So it was a good buy.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, I think a lot of people, when they're getting started, get stars in their eyes about, oh, you know, I'm going to, my first deal is going to be a 27 bedroom HMO. And, you know, I think starting with something like that simple, I mean, the auction thing worries me a little bit, Alice, if I'm honest, but, you know, starting with something simple, a simple buy to let, learn the ropes, learn what it's like to manage tenants, make a bit of capital appreciation if you're, you know, if you buy in the right area. And then once you've got that experience under your belt, you understand how to buy properties and how to deal with tenants and all that sort of stuff, then you can start getting more complicated. But so, yeah, it maybe wasn't the most exciting deal, but it probably taught you a lot along the way.
It did. It you know, it taught me the basics. It taught me how to buy an investment property. It taught me how to manage an investment property, because I was determined that for the first few I would do it myself to learn how to do it. Because obviously, if you put it with a letting agent and you don't know what you're doing yourself, you can't ask the right questions to make sure that they're doing it right. So I did all of that myself, sorted out the deposit scheme myself, just really learnt the ropes of running an investment property. And like you said, I get phone calls day in, day out from new investors who are looking for some advice that will say to me, and I'll say, you know, what are you looking to do? And they'll say, well, I just want to ask you about this house. I've seen a brilliant house. It's on for X amount. I think I can get 8 bedrooms in there, and they'll each rent for this. And I say, well, have you got any experience? No. Have you got any money? No. Have you had any training? Well, I've just started. And that worries me, because I know I am absolutely the type of person that wants everything done yesterday. I don't want to wait for anything, which really means I'm actually in the wrong business. Because property investing and development is a slow burner. It takes time. And you know some developments, some projects can take months, if not years, to actually get off the ground, let alone get developed, renovated and let out. And with property, with anything, you really do need to start with the basics at the beginning. You really, really do. You need to get a grounding. You need to get an understanding. You know, it isn't as straightforward as people think it is. It's a great way of earning a fantastic amount of money and having passive income, or as passive as you can probably get income that's high interest. But definitely you've got to have the foundations there before you can build on.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. So you had a little bit of experience, but then you made a pretty bold leap into the unknown when you left your recruitment job. And I mean, did you have an idea of what you were going to do? You said to your husband, don't worry about it, I've got this under control. But I mean, did you really know at the back of your head what approach you were going to take, what strategies you were going to follow?
I'd already signed up for some formal property training by this point, and I'd already started doing that alongside my job. So I was taking a lot of sort of Fridays off work to go and attend property seminars. My boss couldn't understand why I kept wanting a Friday off work, but anyway. So I'd already started doing that. So I'd got some basic knowledge by this point, and before I'd left my job, I'd already had an offer accepted on a second buy to let. Again, not really knowing what I was doing with that, but I went on, completed on that, did the renovations. That did go a little bit wrong, actually, that one, so I'll tell you a bit about that one later. But, yeah, so I had a bit of an idea. I knew I needed to do at least another one or two buy-to-lets. Again, I'd done the groundwork on the first one, But you kind of look at things differently once you've had some training, because you start to think about making sure that it's absolutely going to work and what you can do if it doesn't work. Because ultimately, you know, we don't know what the property market is going to do. We don't know what interest rates are going to do. We don't know what effect things like Brexit are going to have on the property market. So you have to really make sure that you can assess, you know, everything that's going on and that it's going to work in worst case scenario, not just best. So that probably made me look at the projects that I had been thinking about slightly differently. And there was one that actually I'd offered on, which was going to be a HMO. And once I started my training, I realised that actually that really wasn't going to work at all. And so I lost a bit of money on that, but it was worth losing the money on because it just wasn't going to work.
What was it you did? What changed? What did you learn about that made you realise that specific deal wasn't going to work? Let's see if we can make some other, you know, there's probably a lesson in there that other people might need to be aware of as well, right?
Okay, yeah, absolutely. Very, very simply with property, it doesn't matter how much upfront money you've got, you're never going to have enough and you'll always run out eventually. So I didn't understand that you really have to recycle your money in projects. You can't be going in and buying a property where you're going to be putting 30,000 or 40,000 into the deal that you can't get back. Because if that's all the money you've got, then you're stuck then with that one deal and it might cash flow okay, but you just can't go any further, not until you start to look into private finance and lending, etc. So this deal in particular was being sold through somebody who had done the house up. So the house was really quite nice. So it was ready to go. It was a ready to go investment. And what I realised once I'd done the courses is that wasn't going to work for me because I needed to be able to add value and I needed to be able to add serious value.
So when you're thinking from a momentum point of view and then being able to recycle your cash, like you say, buying these ready-made HMOs didn't allow you to recycle your cash in that way. So you felt, I guess, that it was better to go back to a project that you could do some work to and add value to that way?
Absolutely, absolutely. And my first HMO, that's exactly what I did.
Okay. So is HMOs that you predominantly focus on then?
No, I go down two routes. So when I first started, it was very simply buy-to-lets and basic flips, three-bed semis, things like that, just to to learn the ropes. I moved on from buy-to-lets to HMOs. Although I still do buy-to-lets because I do quite like them. They're the easiest, safest option in my opinion. And there's also a huge, huge requirement for private rental houses at the moment. So as long as you know your area, and if I'm honest, most areas at the moment will rent. Most areas will rent because there's just not enough housing out there. You just have to make sure that obviously the deal stacks up in terms of purchase price and rental income, etc. So I moved on to HMOs for cash flow, but I also have a company that I use for trading. So that's where I do now larger renovations, bigger ones with much bigger profits, and also ground up developments, which I've just started about 4 or 5 months ago, my first ground up development, just a 3-bed detached house.
Great stuff. So you've kind of followed these two strategies. They've just kind of gone down a route of natural progression then from single lets into HMOs and from flips into, I guess, you know, larger development projects and new build developments.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It has been a natural progression and I will continue to go down that route so that, you know, eventually I would hope that to continue with the HMOs, but what I'd like to do is do build to rent, so that I end up with maybe being able to split some. So if I built a block of 12, being able to sell 6 off and rent 6 out, that kind of thing, but actually building that or converting commercial. And then down the other route to just build bigger developments, really, to just build more units.
Yeah, I like hearing stories like this where there has been some logic to it and some, you know, personal development as well, because there are mistakes that can be made. And I would far rather see people make mistakes on the smaller projects, figure out what you've done wrong there, and then start to gradually build up. And it doesn't need to take you years. I mean, you've gone from single lets to HMOs and from flips to new build developments in, you know, 18 months. So you can get there quickly. But just, you know, I just really want to reemphasize the point that if you can start small, it is going to put you in such a better position when you come onto those bigger projects with your own experience and level of knowledge, with lenders who are willing to lend you money, with mistakes that come up. You'll have seen them before in smaller ways, and you can know how to resolve them quicker and easier and cheaper. And, you know, everything that you're saying just resonates so well with me. So I'm very impressed with the approach that you have taken. In terms of the specific deals that you have done so far, what would you say has been your favourite? Is there one that stands out in your mind?
I think probably the HMO, probably my first HMO. There's a few that have turned out really quite well. But the HMO is probably the main one. It was a house in Birmingham, very good area for young professionals. It was a house that actually had come to me, even though it was on the market, it had come to me through a leaflet drop. So I'd walked the streets, was determined I was going to know the area like the back of my hand if I was going to invest heavily there. Got to know some of the locals, some of the business owners, joined the business association there, really made sure that I knew everything I could about this area, and that people knew who I was. Did a leaflet drop, had a phone call from a gentleman who said, oh, Alice, and he phoned me regularly, bless him, and he'd say, there's a house down the road, round the corner, over the park, and just across the lane. Do you know the one I mean? Lovely guy. But this one particularly, he phoned me up and said, there's a house opposite where I live. I think it's what you're looking for. And I sort of thought, oh, you know, it's on the market. I'm not sure. Really wanted something off market. But I thought, do you know what? There's no harm in going and having a look. Now, it was on for offers over 250,000. Now, at that point, that would put a lot of people off because that wasn't going to work for me. And people think that they have to offer over 250,000. You can offer what you want on a property. It doesn't matter what the guide price is. It doesn't matter whether it says offers in the region, offers over. You know, you can offer what you want. There's nothing wrong with phoning the agent and chatting to them. So I phoned up the agent and offered 190 based on my figures, which obviously was considerably below what they were asking for it. They obviously said no to this. I went back, I really wanted it, and said, look, I'll go to 200, but that's it. And he said, no, sorry, that's still way too low. And I said, that's fine, that's really not a problem. That's kind of what I expected. But I'd really like to leave the offer on the table. So if the people that are selling get stuck, or you want to talk to me again at any point in the future, my offer's on the table. About 6 weeks later, I got a phone call from the agent saying, Alice, the sellers are really desperate now. They still haven't got a sale. Do you still want to buy it at 200? And I said, absolutely, absolutely. We agreed a sale. I had a phone call the following day from the agent saying, I'm really sorry, Alice, you won't believe this, but it's been on the market sort of 8-9 months, and we've just had another person offer 220. And I said, well, that's you know, it's the name of the game, isn't it? Nothing I can do about it, you know, but still keep me in mind, I'm still here. 2 days later, he phoned me back up. He said, Alice, we've had the couple that have offered on it at 220 into branch, and their circumstances are far too complicated, and yours aren't. You've offered to buy it really quickly. You've offered to make the process very smooth, and they're going to go with you at 200, even though they've had a higher offer.
Do you think there ever was an offer for 220 there? Do you think there was any element of the agent trying to bid your price up against a kind of non-existent entity, or do you think that was a genuine offer?
I think it was a genuine offer, purely because he didn't push me at any point to raise my offer. Not at any point did he say to me, will you match it? Will you go anywhere near it? Nothing at all. He just said, look, I'm just really sorry. You know, I genuinely am sorry, but what can we do? We've had a higher offer and they can't not go for it. And I just said, that's fine. So I think they were actually genuine in this case.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great result, obviously, to get that sort of, you know, 20% discount on. Was the 250 market value, do you think, or was it a little bit overpriced?
I think at the time it was maybe very slightly overpriced, but it wasn't far off market value.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a couple of things there. I think first is that you were never a motivated buyer. You never thought, I need to have this, and, oh, 220, so maybe I'll put 225 in. You just stuck to your guns. You knew what it was worth to you, and you held out, and you got it. But equally, there's a piece about integrity in there and doing what you say you're able to do. So when the agent came back to you and said, you know, you still want to do it at 200, you'd said to them before, you know, if the offer comes back and, you know, they're willing to look at it, it'll still be there. When he did come back to you, you followed through on it, you completed it, and I'm sure that agent has got a lot of faith in you now for any other deals that you work with them on. If they come back to you and, you know, you make an offer, at least they know it might be a little bit low, but Alice completes, she completes quickly, she does what she says she's going to do, we can rely on her, we can trust her, which is ultimately what agents want, because they don't get paid until the sale's complete. So, you know, it's simple things like that that allow you to secure these deals at such a good price.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I say this to my mentees when I'm working with them. If you say you're going to do something, you need to do it. I put very low offers in with agents on a regular basis. And to start off with, I've had agents put the phone down on me because, you know, they really do think I'm having a bit of a laugh with them. But moving forwards now, agents actually take my offer seriously, even though they're very low, because exactly as you said, they know I'm going to follow through. If I make that offer, unless something happens and we have a survey done and find out the house is falling down or something like that, and even in those cases, we've still bought. I will follow through on anything I say that I'm going to do. And it really does give you some kudos with people. And a lot of agents that I've spoken to said they have obviously a huge amount of calls from investors and wannabe investors that are throwing offers about left, right and centre, but never actually buy anything.
Yeah, no, it's true. You know, it's a tough game for them to be in, stuck between vendors and purchasers. And, you know, like I say, the easier you can make their life, the more they'll want to work with you in future. So a great little lesson there. But let's progress with this case study then. So you were able to buy it for 200,000 at a decent discount below market value. What did you do with it from there?
Okay, so we did a total renovation, slightly larger than expected, because when we went in, we knew that we would have to move a few walls about, just a big wall in the kitchen which had to come down, with a big RSJ going in, a few stud walls. We knew it would be a large renovation. We didn't realise that when we took the wallpaper off the walls that all the plaster was going to fall off as well. So we ended up going back to bare brick, which we weren't expecting, which obviously cost more money. It was a much bigger job and made the process a lot longer, because we were doing it over winter time. So trying to get everything to dry out took a lot longer. Eventually, we converted it into a 6-bed HMO. So we did with 2 bathrooms and a communal kitchen, large communal kitchen. We spent about £72,000 in all, I think, and that was including stamp duty, fees, renovation, everything. And that included sort of finance costs, council tax, gas, electricity, water while we were doing it, everything, which a lot of people miss those little things sometimes, and that can kind of throw a project out if you miss the little things.
A lot of people give you the sort of homes under the hammer figures which don't include anything like that, so it's good to know that that is the, you know, the absolute spend, everything, every little penny that you had to pay.
Absolutely everything. So that was £72,000 in. We had the property refinanced 6 months later, and we got a value of £320,000, which was actually £10,000 more than I was expecting.
Okay, great. That's a good uplift in value.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We refinanced at £256,000. So essentially, we left £16,000 in the deal. Now, at this point, we put it on the rental market and it didn't quite go to plan because we'd put it on with an agent who hadn't done HMOs before. It was my first HMO as well, so there's obviously a lot of rules and regulations surrounding HMO. Even though it wasn't licensed, it wasn't over 3 stories, there was still a lot of things that we had to look at to make sure that we got it right. We put it on with them because they wanted to start doing HMOs, and we decided that because they were new and we were new, we'd work together, they'd do it cheaper for us, and because of that, put a package together, and that they would obviously put the work in because they'd never done it before. It took a lot longer to rent the rooms than expected. And one of the things that we were getting back from people who were viewing, prospective tenants, was that there was no communal area. There was no living room for them to go and sit down in on an evening and have a glass of wine, watch the TV, you know. And we hemmed and hawed about this for a while because I think our return on investment was well over 75% at the time, which is just incredible on a HMO particularly, especially in that area. But because we'd got such a high return on investment, we could afford to drop it down and still really make some good money out of it. We really talked long and hard about this and came to the conclusion that we needed to lose a bedroom. And that even though it was going to bring the return on investment just to just under 50%, that still really was very, very good. So we lost a bedroom, filled the rooms very quickly then. And so far we've had all the tenants have stayed their first 6 months. We've got some of the tenants are rolling over. We've got two tenants that have handed notice in, and within 24 hours, both rooms were refilled. So we did it very, very high spec. It looked a little bit like a boutique hotel, so that people went in. It really had the wow factor.
It's, you know, it's a difficult decision to make that when you look at the kind of Excel spreadsheet and you think, well, you know, six bedrooms versus five bedrooms is obviously going to make me a lot more money. But if it's at the expense of communal space, a whole host of things can chip away at that ROI. Void periods because you can't fill your rooms. You know, you maybe get a lower quality tenant in there. You get tenants who move quicker, so you've got reletting fees and you've got more void periods between tenancies. And, you know, a whole host of things that in your case you've found out having five bedrooms, although on paper the ROI doesn't look as good, it's going to be much easier to manage. And ultimately, without the void periods, without the turnover in tenancies, you probably won't be too far away from where you would have been with the six bedrooms anyway.
Absolutely. And I think there were two things that stood out to me and two main reasons that we made this decision. The first one was because we really did felt that if the tenants could socialise, exactly like you said, they would stay longer. You know, and that was a huge priority for us, was to make sure that we kept our tenants in as long as possible. The second one was I really knew that I wanted to do more HMOs in this area and that people knew me and I want to be able to get business through word of mouth. And so I needed to make sure that that house was as comfortable for those tenants as possible, so that they turn around to their friends and said, oh, we've been in this brilliant house. It had a lovely living room. It had lovely bedrooms, you know. Rather than saying, well, we're in this house, but there was nowhere to sit, we were stuck in our rooms, and that was worth losing a bedroom for, without a doubt. It, you know, it's sort of forward thinking, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, that's an example of a project that has gone well. Have there been any deals or projects that haven't gone to plan along the way?
So the second buy-to-let that I'd offered on prior to me leaving my job, in terms of the actual figures on that deal, it worked fantastically. Return on investment was very high. Got pretty much all of my money back out. It was almost money in, money out. So the actual figure side of things went really well. What happened on that one was I didn't really know what I was doing. So I kind of felt that I could get someone in to do a really, really cheap refurb on that and rent it out. It was clean inside. It was fine. It just needed some updating doing. So I got a friend of a friend's boyfriend who was in the building trade, and he said, I'll come and do it on a weekend for you. And I said, oh great. Okay. Wonderful. Obviously further down the line now, that never happens. That really doesn't happen. The day before I was due to complete and he was due to start, he phoned me up and he said, I'm so sorry, Alice, I've taken on too much. I just can't do it. And I thought, well, great. You know, I'm now left with a house where I'm paying the mortgage on it and the council tax, etc. And I haven't got a build team. So at this point, I panicked a bit. What I should have done was taken some time and thought, well, 3 or 4 weeks isn't going to make any difference. Make sure you get the right people in there. I went to another investor friend of mine who I'd met at a network meeting and said to him, can you help? Do you know anyone? And he said, yes, I've got a build team I can put you in touch with. I went to school with one of the lads, so I know he's trustworthy. Fine. So I phoned these people up and said, and they said, no problem, Alice, we'll be in there Monday. We'll be in there Monday. We'll get it sorted for you. To cut a long story short, they did a really bad job. Particularly of the electrics. The guy that I'd phoned was supposedly a qualified electrician. I didn't check this. I didn't check it because I took the words of the investor friend, because I thought that he knew what he was talking about and that I could trust him, trust his judgment. So I didn't check any of the tradespeople out. I just had them on site in a panic thinking, I've got to get this done, I'm losing money. It transpired towards the end of the deal that I had to get people in to redo all of the electrics at a cost of about £2,500, plus putting some of the plastering right and some of the bathroom right. And I probably lost about £4,000 Not a considerable amount of money. You know, it could have been, if it was 100,000, you'd be thinking, oh my goodness me. 4,000, if I'm honest, probably best money ever spent, because it was probably the best learning I've ever had on a project, was to make sure that you really do check your tradespeople out. It doesn't matter where they've come from, who's recommended them to you. You want to see work that they've done. You want to speak to people that they've actually carried out work for. And you want to be checking that they've got all the relevant qualifications and that they're a member of all the relevant bodies that they need to be able to carry out that work and be able to certify it at the end. Now, the two people that were running the project, my solicitor actually checked up on them at the end, and they'd both been declared bankrupt, and they both had a significant list of people waiting for money off them. And I was at the end of a very long list, and my solicitor just said, Alice, it's not worth it. You're never going to get that money back. It's just not going to happen. Now, those two people have disappeared now. Surprise, surprise. And so that, yeah, like I said, that £4,000 really was money well spent for me, because I'm really cautious now when I use tradespeople. I'm cautious from checking them out, making sure they've got the correct insurance in place, making sure that the site is set up correctly, that they're, you know, wearing the correct protective clothing, masks, headgear, everything that they need. I'm really quite hot on that now. And I probably wouldn't have been had I have not, you know, been screwed over, I suppose, which I was.
Yeah, I mean, I hear what you're saying completely about, you know, it could have been a lot worse. £4,000 is still going to be painful for people who are getting started in property investing.
Oh, it was painful for me, definitely. It was definitely painful for me because I was just starting out and I didn't have an awful lot of money, you know. So, but I think with anything like that, with business, if you let that get to you, you would just stop and give up, and you'd go back to your day job and you'd think, this isn't for me. You have to look at the positives of everything if you can. You've got to.
Yeah. And, you know, the good thing is that it didn't break you and you have gone on to achieve bigger success there. It goes back to what we were saying earlier about making your mistakes on the smaller projects so it didn't end up costing you 20 or 30 grand on, you know, a big commercial or a new build development. But some good tips there as well on doing your due diligence around trades and making sure that, you know, they are who they say they are, they don't have any dodgy past, that you can find out very easily by doing a quick Google search on someone and, you know, just get some recommendations. But don't really, you get a lot of people that have heard someone, oh yeah, such and such, he lives across the road, he's a good electrician, having never used them in his life. And, you know, you really need to make sure that those recommendations are coming from someone who knows what they're talking about and someone who can actually verify and validate them, rather than just, well, I met this guy down the pub and he seemed okay, so why don't you use him? But no, good tips there. A painful lesson to learn, but it's, you know, it's like you say, it could have been a lot worse, and hopefully it will allow others listening to this to do the right checks in future and avoid that same mistake. So in terms of the future of your investing then, I mean, we're still relatively early on in your journey, so I'm sure you've got big plans and a lot of projects and deals ahead of you, but how do you see your business and your strategy evolving over the next couple of years?
I think I would like to obviously expand on what I'm doing at the moment. I don't want to suddenly go out and do something different, because I've got a really good basis and grounding for what I'm doing. I'm still doing lots of training. I've still got a coach. I've still go off to lots of courses to make sure that I know everything I can about what I'm doing. I'd like to continue on to make sure that I've got enough cash flow coming in each month to not only live comfortably myself, and I've already covered my own income, but to be able to really be quite comfortable. I'd like to cover my husband's income as well at some point. Not necessarily so that he can give up work, because he actually loves his job, which is very rare, but really so that he's got a choice. I think it's all about having a choice, and if he can go to the work for the love of it, not because he knows he has to pay the bills, then that's quite a nice position to be in. And then I'd really, really like to be looking for some sort of larger plots of land. Again, I'm not going to suddenly jump from 1 to 20, but I would like to look at 4 units plus on my next deal, and then potentially sort of more after that. So yeah, that's kind of where I'm going with the property side of things. And then I'd also like to continue with my mentoring. I've got two mentees at the moment, which I work with on a monthly basis. having been a primary school teacher for 10 years, it's kind of in my blood, really, to want to pass on knowledge and to teach people. And I absolutely love that side of it. It's not something I'd want to do full time, because obviously to be able to teach people, you need to be doing it yourself. And you need to be understanding all the changes and things. But yeah, going forwards, I'd really like to make sure that I can kind of pass on as much knowledge to as many people as possible, because do you know what? I've had a lot of help along the way. I've had a lot of support. I've made money from people that I've networked with that have made suggestions to me and said, why don't you do this? Or why don't you do this? One person in particular who I made friends with quite early on in my property journey, and he's been absolutely amazing in not only supporting me, offering advice, but also giving me advice on things that really have made me some money quite quickly. So yeah, I'd like to give that back to people now. I'd like to be able to pass that back on and have people doing the same as I'm doing.
Yeah, great stuff. And like you say, you know, being a teacher in your sort of previous career, it kind of makes sense that you want to get back into that side of things. And it's similar to what you were saying about your husband, you know, being able to do something because you love it rather than because you need to. Having that choice is what property investing is all about for me. And it's great to see that, you know, you're able to achieve that similar sort of choice and freedom to do what you want to do.
Yeah, absolutely. It is freedom and choice, definitely.
Well, you've given us a great insight into your own property journey, Alice. Now what I want to do is to give some advice back to our audience. But before we do that, let's just take a minute to thank our sponsors.
Harvey Bowes are a small but perfectly formed team of UK-based independent mortgage brokers. By working with a wide panel of lenders, they can find the best mortgage deal based on your specific requirements. You don't need to worry about dreaded pre-recorded messages and poorly informed call center staff, as unlike comparison websites and high street banks, Harvey Bowes are expert property investors as well as brokers, meaning they're speaking your language and know how best to help your unique situation. Whether it's a simple buy-to-let mortgage or more specialized HMO finance, bridging, development finance, or refinancing your entire portfolio, the team at Harvey Bowes put your best interests first. Speak to their multi-award-winning specialist broker team today and discover the massive difference an expert broker can have on your property investments. Harvey Bowes are much more than just another mortgage company. They are deal creators. Call them on 029-2175-4150 or visit www.harveybowes.com to find out more.
Okay, Alice, what I want to do now is to give some advice back to our audience. And I always like to start this section off by asking our guest, what is the best advice you've ever been given that stuck with you throughout your investing?
I think probably networking. I think that is the thing that made it for me initially, was I made sure that I met up with as many people as possible, whether they were business owners, whether they were developers, investors, whether they wanted to be investors but hadn't started, because it doesn't matter whether you don't learn anything from them. If you can pass on some knowledge, that's great, but you never know when that's going to come back to you. And you never know when somebody that you meet up with in 6 months, 12 months time could just come back and you could think, I'm really pleased I met with that person because now they're investing with me, or they're, you know, just... they've given me a really good piece of advice, they've passed on a property deal, whatever it is. So I think that was probably it, was somebody telling me, you know, you need to get yourself out there, you need to be talking to people, you need to get your face known with agents, everybody, just network.
No, it's how, you know, we have built, I'd attribute a lot of our success to our network and getting out there and meeting people. For people who maybe don't have the natural inclination to put themselves out there, maybe they're a bit introverted, I mean, what sort of places did you go to meet these people? How did you start building these relationships?
Okay, so a lot of the networking that I did was through meeting people through Facebook. So it was really making it quite clear to everybody what I was doing. And I think people are very scared of telling people what they're doing in case they get a negative response. It's not about other people. It's about you, and it's about your family and friends and going forwards. So I... sort of put it out on Facebook. I wrote a bit of a paragraph about what I was doing. I can't even remember whether I might have actually done a video, which I don't particularly like doing, but I thought, you know what? What's the worst that's going to happen? So I told everybody about what I was doing, my change in career. People were really interested and actually much more supportive than I expected. I then got quite a few messages from other investors in the local area saying, do you want to meet up? And I did the same. So I didn't I went to network meetings as well, but if you are a bit shy and you don't like going into rooms with lots of people that you don't know, you know, meet people on a one-to-one basis. Obviously don't put yourself in any danger and make sure that, you know, you go to a public place and that people know where you are, especially if you're female. But you know, go and meet people on a one-to-one basis, have a coffee with them. You know, I drink so much coffee now because I meet with so many people. But you never know where it's going to take you. So, yeah, I would say go over social media, chat with people on Messenger, get to know them first so that you're not turning up to a meeting cold. You have already had that conversation. You do already know a bit about them, what they're doing, where they live, what their background is, and the same for them. And just go and meet up with people. I decided when I first did my training and left my job that I was going to make sure that I met with at least one new person every week, and that's what I still do.
Superb. Yeah, I think, you know, it's great to set yourself little goals like that and just hold yourself accountable, because when you're working for yourself, nobody else is going to do it. You need to have that drive and that rigor in simple things like networking to start to see these results. But it's obviously worked very well for you, Alice. So, yeah, a great bit of advice there. In terms of tools and resources, have you got any that you rely on to make your life easier when you're investing?
I'm a bit of a wing and a prayer person, actually. I'm kind of the person that sort of, you know, jumps off a mountain, jumps off a cliff and builds my parachute on the way down. But, you know, I mean, don't get me wrong, I still make sure that I do all the relevant checks and stress tests and exit strategies and all the things that you need to do. But I do like to kind of just jump in feet first.
You get a gut feel for stuff, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things more recently that's been really, really useful to me is my brother-in-law actually runs a company doing CGIs, which are sort of digital drawings of rooms, houses, developments, of what they're going to look like once they're finished. So I can then get an idea of what I'm working towards, and we can also use those obviously for marketing prior to things being finished, which is really useful. One of the things that I found, and it's only a little thing, but he obviously does floor plans for me, and I will have to dress these properties for sale, and I'm not an interior designer, so trying to work out what to put where and what's going to look right is quite difficult. Now he can actually place things in the room on a floor plan for me and say, no, that's too big, that's too small, that needs to go there. That's been really useful for me recently, for me to just phone him up and say, can you just make those sofas a bit smaller, please? Can I just see what they look like? So he's been brilliant in doing that. Yeah.
Good stuff. Yeah, no, I think there are a lot of advantages to getting those renders done. And it used to be exclusively available to developers with very deep pockets working on, you know, multi-million pound projects. But obviously it helps for you, the fact you've got your brother-in-law on hand. But you can get a lot of this stuff done at a very reasonable price. And like you said, Alice, for you, the advantages are being able to lay out rooms and things beforehand, but you can recoup a lot of that cost by either selling or renting the rooms off plan or adding extra value, because people perceive things like 3D renders as a higher class of product, so they might be willing to pay a little bit more for it as well. So although there might be a little bit of investment, it's a lot less than it used to be, and I think, you know, it's money well spent.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, you know, for some of these now, if you just want a one-off room or you just want the front of a house or whatever, you're looking at hundreds, not thousands, to have that done. And it is so worth the money.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you got a favourite book that has inspired you and helped you to achieve some of this success?
I've read lots of books, which, again, is one thing I would always advise when you become an investor, and not just property books. You need to read business books. You need to read mindset books. There's a couple that have kind of resonated with me. One of the things that people find when they start property investing is that they will put an awful lot of effort into things for 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, and they don't get anything back from it, so they give up. You know, and a lot of people that go on these property courses and pay tens of thousands of pounds, which is exactly what I did too, they just think that once you've done that, everything's going to sort of fall in your lap, and it doesn't work like that. And sometimes it can take 12, 18 months, 2 years to get to where you want to be. One of the books that was brilliant for that kind of mindset is a book called The Slight Edge by Jeff Olson. And for me, it just made me realise that a lot of the things that you put in don't necessarily come back to you straight away, but it's a little bit about the compound effect. It's about doing things, little bits of things constantly, keeping going, keeping going. You think nothing's happening. And then before you know it, all of a sudden, everything happens at once and you go, oh, it worked, you know. So I think that was a really, really good book. I've just got one other book, which I can't remember who it was by. It's called You Are a Badass. And as I said, I can't remember who it was by, but there was just one quote in that book. It was a really good book. The whole book was good, but there was one quote in that book that has stuck with me and has probably helped with me being a successful investor. And I was getting quite anxious a lot of the time and worrying about what was going to happen. I was worrying about money. I was worrying about where it was going to come from, how I was going to pay people, all of the things that, you know, are really, really common in investing. Cash flow is probably one of the biggest issues when you're an investor. And I was getting really anxious and it was stopping me sleeping. I was getting worried. I was struggling with everything to the point where I was thinking, I'm not sure I can do this, especially on my own. And one of the things it said in this book is, if you're depressed, you're living in the past. If you're anxious, you're living in the future. And if you're content, you're living in the here and now. And it kind of expanded on that. And it said, don't worry about the past because that's gone. You can't change it. Don't worry about the future because it'll never come. It's not here. Think about what you're doing at this very moment in time. And at this very moment in time, I'm sitting having a lovely chat with you, Mike. And everything's good. The kids are at school and college, husband's at work. Everything is fine. And so my mindset now, if I start to panic about things, I think, right, where am I? What am I doing? Right, I'm sitting in a coffee shop with my mum or whatever it is, and everything is fine. Don't worry about what's coming. Deal with that then. Think about the here and now. And that was a really big thing for me, and that's kind of pulled me through, you know, a lot of mindset stuff.
Yeah, no, it's a great outlook and a great little quote to keep in mind as well. I've just Googled it as well, Alice. It was written by Jen Sincero, by the looks of things. Bright yellow book cover. Anyway, as we do with all the books that are recommended, we'll make sure we put a link to that on the show notes page. Now, finally, if people want to find out more about you and what you've got going on, you mentioned a few ways that you're looking to work with people and you can help other people, but equally people might just want to see the projects that you have got coming up in the future. Where can they go and how can they get in touch with you?
Okay, so they can contact me personally on Facebook. My Facebook's open because I use it mainly for business, so that's just Alice Nock, which is N-O-C-K. They can email me, alice@la-homes.co.uk. If you want to have a chat with me further, please feel free to drop me an email. We do have a Facebook page, LA Homes, again, if you want to have a look at some of the projects that we've done. It's actually not that up to date because I'm not the social media person, but there are projects on there. So if you want to see some of the stuff we've done, please take a look. And I do need to update that with some of the more recent projects so that people can see what we're up to.
I'd frame that as you're too busy doing work to spend time posting pictures on social media. No, it's an important part of what we all do, I think, is building that branding. But I know that you are busy. And, you know, it's great to see that, you know, you've got so much going on in the real life that, you know, sometimes social media does get forgotten about. But we will make sure that there are links to all of those places that you mentioned on your show notes page, Alice. That just leaves me to thank you for taking the time to be with us. It's been great to hear about your story, about how you got started in property and about your plans for the future. I'm sure it's going to be an extremely enjoyable and interesting, successful journey for you that we will watch with, you know, real interest. And hopefully we get the chance to catch up again soon. But for now, thanks again for your time. And we'll speak soon.
Oh, you are very, very welcome. And I very much appreciate you inviting me along for the chat. Thanks, Mike.
I really appreciate you listening to the podcast, but I would love it if you can leave us a review in iTunes as well. Let me know what you think of the show and how we can make it better. Thanks.